You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast, we are going to do a homestead update. I want to let you know what's going on around here, what we've completed here recently, and some things that we have coming up. Last week, we did a couple interviews. I think they were really good on entrepreneurship, off-grid living, things like that. So please check those out if you have not done so. The podcast is doing well. It's not huge by any stretch of the imagination, but we have surpassed over 1,300 downloads a month and growing. So that's encouraging. That's good. When we started this 6 months ago or whatever it was, nobody was listening, and that's what we expected, and that's kind of one of the lessons learned for life is that you just have to start. You have to, if you're going to go for something, you have to begin. You have to start. You can't wait for the perfect. You can't wait to build an audience before you start talking or writing or whatever it is. You just got to start, and even knowing that nobody's going to listen. And, you know, and quite honestly, not a lot of people are listening now, but we are getting lots of feedback. So there are there are some listeners out there, and so that's encouraging, and so we keep going. Now, with this time of year, it's extremely busy, which is a good thing. So we're able to accomplish a lot of projects, and we've been doing a lot. So I'm going to cover some of those things today, and then, like I said, a few future projects, so some near-term projects that we're hoping to accomplish over the next couple months. But first, I want to talk to you about something that's very exciting. We're looking forward to it. Is our first workshop that we're launching in June. So I want to talk about that very briefly, and then we'll get into some of the other updates. Okay, so we're launching what we're calling Introduction to Homesteading. It's a workshop. Right now we have two of them planned, and they're kind of test beds, but I mean these are well planned out, and it's going to be great information. It's going to be great information for those that are interested in homesteading, that want to learn about it, that may be dabbling in it and want to launch into it. So June 13th and July 18th. These are our two planned workshops and their Introduction to Homesteading. All right, and so what this is about is it's for those that want to exit the rat race, but they're not really sure where to start. And so they're looking for a more sustainable way to live, a little bit more of a lifestyle that is conducive to family, community, but also to be able to make a living. Okay, this is a very important aspect of it. It's not an easy thing to do. And part of that is managing your expectations and kind of doing an evaluation, looking at your current life and going, hey, is it worth it? Is it worth me doing what I'm doing so that I can have lots of stuff? You know, is there something more fulfilling out there? And I believe that you know, part of that is this type of lifestyle. So we're excited about it. We're hoping to launch this and kick it off right. And so we're very excited. And I want to give you kind of the rundown on some of the things that we're going to be talking about. So obviously, one of the reasons is to help people understand why they want to do this, why they want to homestead. And so we're going to talk about that, because that's really important. And when things get hard, which they will and they do, it's important that you remember why you're doing this in the first place. Because if we make decisions simply based on efficiency or that kind of thing, you're not going to homestead, okay? You're not going to grow your own food if you're going to just purely look at certain aspects. There's lots of tangible and intangible aspects to each area of homesteading, and it's really important that you understand why you're doing the things you're doing. Okay, and with that, we talk about changing your mindset. So renewing your thinking on those types of issues. All right. So, for example, when you look at growing your own food, somebody might just simply do a cost analysis and say, oh, based on your time and effort and all this other stuff, it's much more efficient to simply go to Costco and buy food. Well, you need to look at multiple aspects. I mean, number one, you will save money if you do it with particular methods, etc. You know, but some people might say, well, but that your labor, your the time that you put into that, you know, you're making minimum wage. You know, again, this is a false paradigm when we start looking at time as money. Okay, I really believe that. Time as money is our industrial way of thinking. That doesn't take into account family. It doesn't take into account community. It doesn't take into account your health. It doesn't take into account the nutritional value of the food that you grow on your own property. It doesn't take into account the freshness of, you know, all of these things. So that's part of it. We want people to understand that difference. So it's a changing of your mindset, which is an important part of entering into the homesteading realm. Okay, we also talk about choosing land and methods of homesteading. So we're going to go into some detail about land. So whether you know someone might want raw land and build upon it and all those kinds of things. They might want to be off-grid. They might want to be on-grid or partially off-grid. Different methods. Are you going to do the traditional homesteading model with the large annual garden and your chickens over here, etc.? Part of our bent is obviously permaculture, and we bring that into the introduction to homesteading. It makes so much sense to us, so that's our bent. But we talk about different methods of homesteading. All right, for example, one of our classes is establishing a food forest for not only sustainability, as in it will produce lots of food over long periods of time, but you know, food sovereignty. It doesn't take a bunch of recurring inputs once you can establish something like a food forest, as opposed to an annual garden, which requires yearly inputs for a lot of output. No doubt about it. So, in an annual garden, you put in a lot of inputs, you get a lot of outputs. A food forest, initially you're going to put in a lot of inputs, and initially you're not going to get a lot of outputs. Okay, but that reverses itself over long and stays that way over long periods of time. Long periods of time. A food forest can produce for literally hundreds of years. Okay, and the more that it establishes itself, the more output you get for a diminishing set of inputs. And so to me, that's a good reason to establish a food forest. Okay, again, not at the expense of an annual garden. There's nothing wrong with an annual garden. Why not do both? Okay, so you get with the annual garden, you get a lot of outputs right away. At the same time, hopefully, you know, you're establishing a food forest, which then will flip this. And, you know, as time goes on, if for whatever reason you're not able to put as much work into your annual garden as you get older, guess what? Your food forest is now producing much better. Anyway, that's one of the things we talk about is establishing a food forest. We talk about annuals versus perennials, which is this very concept. We talk about determining how much you should plant and what kinds of things that you should plant. So whether it's perennials or annuals, we talk about both of these. So trying to determine, you know, how much of a family of eight or a family of four, you know, how much should you plant to make an impact? I mean, because, you know, if you just plant a little container garden off your back porch, it's nice and that's a good thing and you're learning, but it's not going to make an impact on your food bill, on your health or things like that. So, you know, we need to up the production, and that's an important part of it, of homesteading. We have lunch is included in this. So we provide lunch, and then we're going to do a probably about an 8-stage walking tour of our permafarm, of our homestead. So we go to each area and we discuss how we have set up, each element and how all these elements work together. Because that's, to me, that is an integral part of our methodology, is that all of these elements work together. Each element has multiple functions and they interact with each other. Okay, so in other words, the chickens have an interaction with the food forest, which have an interaction with the annual garden, which have an interaction with our pasture, etc. So all these things work together. We don't have this stovepiped elements in, each in their own little area. So this is an important part, and so we're going to go to each stage and discuss that. We come back from that walking tour and we have a class on how to choose livestock. So we have this discussion on choosing livestock, whether it's goats or sheep or cows or chickens, rabbits, ducks, we have that discussion. And a lot of that's going to be based on individual property, land, availability, things like that. So it's not... One of the most important aspects is like, hey, let's take a look at the property and see what's right for this property. Not trying to shove, well, I want this, and so I'm going to make my property work for this. Instead, let's get the right livestock for the property, and that will help you down the road. And we specifically, after that, we talk about what we call backyard poultry and rabbits. So we talk about this operation in a little bit of detail as an example. Okay, so as far as production and what can you expect, how you take care of and raise small livestock. Okay, we have another class on cow or goat deciding factors, and we're even doing a milk challenge. So we're going to have some cow milk and goat milk and see if people can tell the difference. All right, and then we also will talk about growing and processing your own meat. Okay, so all these things kind of work together, but we distinctly want to hit upon these subjects to include a demonstration. Okay, so we do a demonstration on processing a meat, whether it's a chicken or a rabbit or something like that. So we go through the whole process of dispatching and cleaning all the way down to the processing inside. Okay, so when possible, we're going to do that, which this summer, obviously, we will do that. We talk about food preservation methods. Now, everything that I'm saying, this is a lot. And so even though in certain areas we go down into some detail, we really have to do kind of an overview of these methods and these topics, because there's so much to it. I mean, so much. But we do an overview of food preservation methods, fermentation, freezing, dehydrating, canning, etc. And then we finish off with a goal-setting session for homestead success. And I honestly think this is one of my strong suits, just based on my experience of planning and setting goals. And so we help people try to determine what are their long-term goals and help them start down the road of getting there. So like I said, this is a jam-packed workshop. I think it's going to be really beneficial for those that come. And I think we have a max student capability of about 20. So we're getting the word out here very soon. And if you know anybody that's within proximity or they're willing to travel half day, we'll also do a kind of a camping thing on Friday night and then do the Saturday workshop. They can camp again on Saturday night if they want to. So those types of things are available. So help us spread the word. All right. So that kind of covers our workshops. There's more workshops to come, but those are the only two that I want to talk about. The next item, as far as an update, is Prosser. We're going down. In fact, this coming weekend, we're going down to Prosser, Washington, for what's called the Rattlesnake Rendezvous. That's May 2nd. Rattlesnake Rendezvous in Prosser, Washington. There's basically it's a 1-day conference being held there. I've been asked to speak. This conference is about building strong families, communities, preparedness, that kind of thing. So that's pretty exciting, and we're looking forward to it. We're getting a chance to go down there. I'm speaking, and my topic is permaculture for preparedness. Okay, so a lot of things that I talk about here on this podcast is what I'm going to be hitting down there and talking about how a permaculture as a design science or as a methodology of thinking is excellent for preparedness for many reasons. So that's coming up this coming weekend. And then the next item on my list here is we have our sheep lambed. We have a couple of lambs running around out there, which is really cool. And one of the things I want to talk about as far as sheep is their resiliency. These guys are awesome. I mean, we did nothing. We literally just woke up in the morning and looked out and saw lambs. I remember the first lambing, I got down to about 20 degrees that night. This was a couple weeks ago. And we just came out and you can literally, the lamb was still wet and mama was, you know, cleaning off. We have two of them. And we, in fact, we're expecting one more. We'll see. But they're very resilient, very hardy, and they're doing well. I mean, 2 weeks now, and they're just booming around the pasture and integrated into the flock and doing good stuff. It just required nothing from us. So that's exciting. We have done some significant pasture expansion. I've talked about this a little bit. And actually, the last time I talked about this was a future project. It's now complete. Of course, we're still working on improving that pasture, and that's going to take some time. It's going to take years, in fact, because we're not plowing it up and reseeding it and doing all that kind of stuff. We're not. We're going to use animals. We're going to use intensive management to improve that pasture. We're going to run our herbivores through those pastures, followed by birds, to slowly improve it over time. Now, we may do some spot planting of clover and things like that in certain areas. But that's about it. No major overhauls of the pasture. I'm not a big fan of plowing up fields and planting pasture. So we'll take our time to improve it and see how that goes. But we have easily doubled the size of our pasture. Not that it's extensive, but nonetheless, we've doubled it. So we now have our main pasture, we have a north pasture, and then we have a southeast and a northeast pasture. So we've expanded it quite a bit and have even paddocked down our east pasture down to southeast and northeast. We have more to go. And so most of that is doing cross fencing inside of our current pastures. Okay, that's mostly what we need to do. And that will really help. So we are moving our animals pretty often, but not as much as I want to. And I'm not able to do that until we can get our cross fencing in place. But it's coming along very nicely. The next item is one of our long-term projects that we made some significant progress on is our food forest. And I talked about some of the benefits of establishing a food forest. And we have one. It's about maybe not quite an acre, a little bit less than an acre, a food forest that's in it's in the very early stages. So like I mentioned before, a lot of inputs right now, not a whole lot of outputs. But that's going to change over time significantly. So what we did is we got it completely fenced in. We had to put up 6-foot welded wire fencing around this because the deer would just, they would get all their outputs this year, no problem. I mean, they're prevalent around here and they would get at this food for us. That's like a salad bar to them. Ice cream, in fact. So we were able to completely fence it in to include this food forest is on terraces. Okay, it's just how our property is designed and sloped, so it's a good spot for a food forest. It's got good sun exposure, and it's even got some a wetter area of the food forest and some drier areas, so we can take that into account as we do our plantings. But right now we've got fruit trees and fruit bushes in there. We planted some spot clover in there. We've got I put in 15 black locust trees in there in strategic places. And black locust is excellent for many reasons. Not the least of which is that they are a nitrogen-fixing tree, which means they pull nitrogen from the air and deposit it into the ground, which, of course, help the fruit trees. See, because I'm not putting fertilizer stakes and all this other stuff. Now, I might put manures and things like that in this food forest, but there's no chemical fertilizers going in there. So we use basically this concept of companion planting in order to accomplish that end. So again, just like I've been talking about so much, all these different elements work together and they have multiple functions. So the black locust tree is an excellent lumber. It's an excellent fuel wood. It can be coppiced. In other words, you can cut it every certain amount of years and it's going to continue to come back. It fixes nitrogen, so it pulls nitrogen out of the air and deposits into the soil. It is a forage for animals. Okay, there's some controversy associated with that. Some people say no, and some people say yes. I've read a lot of people who do at least feed some black locust leaves and things to their animals, and they do fine. In fact, there's a process called shredding where people will actually strip the leaves before fall, dry them out, and that becomes almost like a hay for some of their livestock. So that's pretty cool. We may experiment with that. But either way, due to the nitrogen fixing and the fuel wood, those are the main reasons why we want black locust in and amongst our food forest. So we put 15 of them in there. We also have our chicken tractor, chickens and turkeys that are going through the food forest, okay, in a tractor. So in other words, that's our fertilizer right there. So they're moving through. And we've got many more plantings to do there. We put in like 36 strawberry plants in that area. We've got a bunch of elderberry that are going to go in. We'll have some nut trees. We even talked about even putting a stand of sugar maple in there, but not quite sure about that yet. So either way, a ton more trees to go in there and bushes. We're going to be putting comfrey in there and, you know, other dynamic accumulators and green manures. So all these things will hopefully work together to establish itself into a very productive food forest over the next, you know, few years. So that's exciting. Our annual garden. So again, I talked about this, nothing wrong with an annual garden, but we do put more emphasis on our perennial systems than our annual systems. But nonetheless, we have an annual garden because it's very productive right away. Just requires a lot of work. But we have a bunch of starts going in our kitchen. And we have some of our plants in in the ground already. We have some kale and things like that. But our last frost is middle of May. And so, you know, this is all planned out and going into the ground at particular times, whether they're starts or being direct sow. All right, so those are the things that we've done here lately and that we have going on, some updates with that. And then I want to talk to you just about a few future projects. So these are near-term projects to be accomplished in the next month or two, probably in the next month, hopefully in the next month. And the first one is a woodshed. We're going to build a woodshed, and that this is literally for fuel wood. Right now we're using under our deck, and that's being used to store straw and hay and different feeds. So a lot of these types of projects cascade on themselves, and necessity becomes the mother of invention, the mother of construction. Because our barn project, which we need to do an expansion on, is not complete and won't be for a while, therefore we have to use underneath our deck for some of those types of functions. Therefore, we don't have a whole lot of area to store fuel wood. Now, we could do, you know, between the trees and tarp it and that kind of thing, and that's fine. But what we really want is a woodshed that's going to be positioned well and that's going to serve us for a long, long time. So we have that project in mind, and we've got it set up so it's south-facing, so it'll help season the wood and all of that. So that's going in real soon. Now, we're saving some money. A lot of our construction is we're using pole construction from wood from our property. So there's a huge slash pile near our property. We've salvaged a lot of logs out of it for fence posts, for gates, and for pole construction. So we've got a bunch of cedar and larch that we've peeled, and those logs are seasoning, and they'll become the foundation for our woodshed, things like that. So we're not going to go to Home Depot and buy our treated, you know, 4x4s. We're going to use pole construction as much as possible. Now we'll do things like cement them in, and you know, for the foundation, we'll probably make the design based on that and use some pallets to get the wood up off the ground, get airflow. But I think we can do a nice big woodshed for less than $200. Okay, and that's excellent. People will spend thousands of dollars on woodsheds, or you know, just a shed that costs thousands of dollars and use it for wood. We're going to do it for less than $200. All right, the next project, in fact, this project is we're starting this project today, and that's to develop a spring. Okay, we've got a couple of springs on this property. You know, they're not great flowing springs, you know, pushing out of the ground at, you know, 10 gallons a minute or anything like that. But there are water there that is flowing from the ground. And in fact, we have a seasonal stream that's spring fed. All right. Now what we want to do is we're looking for ways to slow spread and soak that water. Because as it is, it just runs through a little draw through our property. It makes for a nice, beautiful little stream, and it runs off of our property. Okay, we need to stop that. We need to slow it down, spread it out, and soak it into the ground, which is the best place to store water. So part of that is developing that spring. So in other words, digging out a portion of it, constructing a small spring, again, very cheap materials, and being able to direct that water, okay? Being able to use that water, whether it's for irrigation or animals or even just slowing it down, spreading it out and letting it soak in. Okay, so there's that. So we're going to now I've never developed a spring before, so we'll see how this goes. Try and get a little bit of footage of this to be able to use that water and store it, and then use it during dry periods. Now that spring, I'm really interested in knowing if we dig it out properly, if we can get it to flow year round. Now I don't think that we will be able to, at least in the first year, but I think with certain strategies that we implement, we might be able to turn this spring into a year round spring. People have success doing that. They have streams that are seasonal, but by implementing certain strategies and recharging groundwater, etc., on their property, they're able to turn something that's seasonal into a year-round, or at least extending it. So if our seasonal stream runs 6 months out of the year, even if we can get it to run 8 months out of the year, that's a huge improvement. Now there's another, besides that spring development, we're going to put in a series of check dams along that seasonal stream. Now, check dam is a very old technology, simple idea of just slowing down the velocity of the water. Okay, so it's not designed to be an actual dam to hold it up and then overflow it. It's designed to slow it down. Okay, so it'll build up a little bit and slow down. And then if we put in a series of those check dams, that's going to slow down that velocity, the flow of that water. That water will hang out just a little bit longer. It'll soak in just a little bit more, etc. So all those things will work together to hopefully improve our seasonal stream. So spring development, check dams, and rainwater catchment. All right, so you can see the theme here. So we're shifting to water big time. Which is important. I mean, we have a functioning well, and it's working out, but you can never have enough water on a property, especially when you're running as many animals as we are, and you're trying to grow as much food as we are in a small space. All right, so rainwater catchment, we're going to put that stuff in place off of our roofs. All right, now really, I just want to back up real quick. All of this is rainwater catchment, okay? The spring development ultimately is from rainwater. The check dams are ultimately rainwater, from that surface water, that collection. Also, simple things like a drainage ditch. Now, we don't do drainage ditches to get the water off our property as fast as possible. It'll be more like a drainage ditch to get that water to flow into the seasonal stream to go through the check dams to be slowed down, etc. You get my point. Swales. We're actually going to be putting in swales this week. So that's a huge thing. Now, what I wanted to do is turn our swales into a linear food forest. That's going to have to wait, but we are going to dig the swales, and we'll probably just throw a cover crop on the swales. So clover, for example, which is a great forage. It's a nitrogen fixing. It'll help prep that area to receive trees and bushes later. Okay, so a swale is nothing more than a ditch that's on contour. Again, the purpose, slow spread and soak the water. Okay, so all of these things are coming up. We also have a small solar project that we want to implement here real soon. And that's for our barn. Our barn is quite a ways distance from our home. Not a long distance, but we don't have any power out there. Okay, so my goal for that solar project is that we put in enough solar to run a couple of heat lamps. Okay, so that, right there, that's going to be, those are pretty high watt items, so that might be about 500 watts total if you just imagine running two heat lamps and some LED lighting. Okay, that's it. That's all we want to do out there. I don't need to run power tools or anything else. The draw off the heat lamps will be challenging enough. Now, if we have to, you can use, there's 125 watt heat lamps, and that's fine, and that would bring us down to 250 watts plus, say, 50 watts for lighting, We could probably do a 300 watt system. Okay. So that's coming up pretty quick. And we'll see how that goes. So that, I'd say in the next month, maybe month and a half, is our goal to complete all those projects. So the woodshed and all of the water development, the swales, the springs, the check dams, the rainwater catchment. That's a huge, huge factor. I'm really looking forward to that because I think that's going to take our homestead to the next level of sustainability, of preparedness, of just a better functioning homestead, instead of just relying on a well. And the solar project. Okay, so that's the update for today. Other than that, we appreciate everybody listening and your feedback. We've been getting good feedback and, you know, some criticism, but that's okay. Mostly due to our worldview. No problem there. That's just going to happen. And that about sums it up. Our scripture for today comes from Psalm 126. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then they said among the nations, "The Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad." That was Psalm 126, 1 through 3. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.